The Judiciary Committee will come back to order. It's about a quarter to six on Wednesday afternoon, April 18th, 2007. We have a quorum to do business. All senators are present: McGuire, Huggins, Terrio, Wilikowski, myself, French. Mr. Bullock is here. We are still working on SB 104. The CS has been adopted. We are working our way through an overview presented by Mr. Bullock and Ms. Davis, who I imagine will be here shortly. And let's continue where we left off, Mr. Bullock.
All right, actually, I'm going to back up a little bit from where we left off.
Very good. What page are we on?
It's a similar provision on page 21, line 27, and on page 22 and line 26. Page 22, line 26. If you recall that there was language in the Senate Resources version that said, if the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission does not have a rebuttable presumption in effect that roll-in rate treatment applies to the cost of the expansion of the project, that the person that receives the inducement could participate in the hearing before FERC. That language is deleted out of this version, both for the royalty inducement and the tax inducement. And it, in a way, that was just like whether they could go there and argue or not. It doesn't affect what the FERC decision would be. It's just who could participate and when they could speak and when they should be quiet.
Questions or comments about that?
And I did discuss that with Deputy Commissioner before she left.
Very good.
So on page 24, lines 4 to 7, actually on line 5, we added after license issued under this chapter. Before it just said license, so that's just clarifying language. And also on lines 6 and 7, the language was changed to require the constitutional challenge to this chapter in a court of the state of competent jurisdiction. So this directs them to Superior Court. Again, on these issues of court appeals and whether or not they can appeal or not, if it's a constitutional issue, it's going to go to a court of competent jurisdiction. Because in the K&L Distributors case, which was a case that came under that those investment credits in the 60s, the court looked at it and then said, even though the legislature put in language saying that the decision was final, not subject to appeal, that on a due process challenge, the court would still consider the appeal.
There's only so far you can restrict someone's due process rights before the court steps in and essentially overrides our attempted restriction.
Right.
Sure.
The Constitution's still there and overrides anything that we might do here. On page 24, lines 24 to 28, this section has to do with a commitment of the state that they won't give the same benefits to a competing pipeline project that are given to the license in this act. It applies to giving inducements to producers that might use the other line, as well as benefits to the competing gas line, such as offering state money or other treatment. The treble damages, there's still a treble damage, but the measure of it's different in here. In this version, the treble damages are three times the amount of the expenditures incurred and paid by the licensee that are qualified expenditures for the purposes of 439110. So those qualified expenditures under 439110 are the same expenditures that the state offers the money for as the inducement. So it's a narrower group of expenses that you're tripling.
Questions or comments on that subject? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Bullock.
On the next page, page 25, lines 5 to 11. Earlier in this section, this is again in the assurances and competing gas line issue, it says preferential royalty or tax treatment does not include the several things that are in A, B, and C. That's just so that the normal administration of tax programs and royalty programs and applying the law isn't considered a preferential royalty or tax treatment, even if it would happen to benefit a competing line.
Senator Terrio has a question, Mr. Bolt.
So the agency could do something like the Uguruk royalty modification, continue that with...
Probably. I mean, that some of that could be arguable if the purpose of the adjustment was to benefit that line. But generally, if it's a law that's passed, if the tax structures changes, that's not prevented by this.
Okay. Thank you.
So that it talks about statutory change or change in regulations. In C, on line 10 on page 25, it says the benefits of a large project permit coordinator authorized by law. This is kind of vague, and in the Department of Natural Resources, they have these large project permit coordinators. For example, there's one for the Pebble Mine. There's a large mine. They're not clearly authorized by a particular statute like this gas line coordinator that's created in this bill, but they have the general authority to manage how the permits are considered. So that's why that reference is a little bit vague. Farther down in lines 13 to 16 on page 25, this is in the subsection and the assignment section that has to do with transferring all or part of a license, including rights and obligations. So this is an assignment issue related to the license itself. And it requires that the commissioners publish notice of a proposed transfer or assignment, including giving the legislature notice and providing at least 30 days for public review and comment. And farther down at the bottom of the page, in line 20, page 25, lines 31 through page 26, line 4. The voucher is a new concept that's introduced in 4390-330. That's the one we talked about earlier. Somebody that's going to buy gas from a producer gets the voucher after they've committed to capacity in the pipeline, and then they have the capability of transferring that voucher. I suggest you ask the administration how this is supposed to work. The way I read it is that the voucher transfers between people that would be buying gas from the gas producer, but I don't think it applies to the transfer of the voucher to the gas producer. But I'm not clear on that particular provision.
And Senator, could you just go over that concern again?
This has to do with the assignment of the voucher. Mm-hmm. And there's two situations where that voucher might be transferred. There's the specific section, provision 4390-330, in which the person that buys that gets that capacity in the pipeline and wants to get, and they don't have their own gas, and they want to buy gas from a particular producer. So they enter up into a binding purchase agreement with that gas producer, and as part of the consideration, they give them that voucher. The other thing is if two utilities transfer the voucher between themselves. In that case, the first utility that's going to buy gas might transfer it to a different utility that's going to buy the gas. And this requires that if the voucher is transferred, that total committed capacity from the pipeline follows the voucher.
So. Now I have a question about that. And I see Commissioner Galvin's here, and I don't know how eager he is to answer questions, but
I'll give my best shot.
Commissioner,
for the record, on the record? My name is Pat Galvin, Commissioner of Revenue.
Is this assignment section specifically between two non-gas producers, the transfer of the voucher, or is this also supposed to address the transfer between the person that gets the voucher that transfers the voucher and the inducements to the gas producer?
Well,
is it like between two utilities or between a utility and the gas producer?
The voucher may be transferred between two utilities, but ultimately it's not going to be of any value until it's transferred to a producer. Basically, it has to go back to somebody who is a lessee.
Who has gas.
Who's selling gas.
Selling gas.
And basically it has to go back to a lessee who's going to use it for the royalty provisions, and it has to be somebody who would be paying the production tax in order to have any value on the production tax angle. So it may be transferred between non-producer entities, but ultimately the purpose of the the voucher is to allow a non-lessee, hey, she made it back, to be able to participate with in this inducement. And since it is a property right, to, I mean, it's something that can be transferred to another third party for whatever value. And then ultimately it needs to get back to a producer in order to be then presented to the state as part of sort of completing that circle and being used on the royalty provision or on the tax provision. And again, it's tied to the quantity of gas that is committed. And again, it could be that I think Mr. Bullock referenced all the gas that's committed. It's actually, it allows for flexibility so that it's tied to a particular quantity of gas, not necessarily all the gas that a particular person were to commit to, because they may choose to break it up into different pieces and provide it to different parties because of the commercial relationships that they enter into.
That is a person who so let's break it down into numbers so we can follow it. If you take a commitment to ship a BCF a day in the pipeline, you get a voucher that's good for a royalty in kind and a tax freeze BCF a day. You get those provisions applying to a BCF a day. Now you may take that voucher and turn to BP or Conoco and say, I want to buy half of this B from you, Conoco, and half of this B from you, BP. So now my voucher gets split in two as to those two producers. And each one of them now has a royalty in kind, royalty in value switching deal, and a tax freeze deal good for half a B a day.
Correct.
Right. Now, what about this D section on page 25 that refers to a person receiving the voucher? Is that, do we anticipate that being the person making the firm transportation commitment, the person?
Could it be us?
This is Marcia Davis, Deputy right. Commissioner.
Walk me through who those Department people are. using that same hypothetical.
Under D, D was intended to address only the gas purchaser, which in this case.
And let's say it's Calpine.
Pick let's a name. Say Calpine.
Calpine.
Calpine
decides to bid for a BCF a day in the pipeline.
Correct. Calpine's voucher can only be assigned if Calpine transfers the complete contract rights it has in the pipeline to someone else, or Calpine itself is sold to another legal entity. This provision D was only intended to address the assignment by the originator of the pipeline capacity acquisition in the initial pipeline. So as far as the transferability amongst by BP or by
BP can't trade it to Exxon.
They cannot trade it. Those are non-transferable.
It stops there.
It stops amongst them, and its duration is limited to the earlier of either the term of the gas contract, sales contract, or operational law, whichever expires first.
But what about Calpine? Can Calpine sell it to Shell Oil Company if they want to?
Calpine could sell it to Shell Oil if it essentially transferred $1 billion, the entire capacity that it acquired at the initial binding open season. It can transfer it to Shell or BP or anyone if it assigns essentially the contractual obligation to pay for that capacity that they acquired in the initial open season to another entity. In other words, someone steps completely into their shoes.
In its entirety. They couldn't sell the whole thing to BP.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
That's correct.
BP could say, I guess I'm ready to be a shipper now.
Absolutely.
I'll take 100% of Calpine's B.
Right. We did not want to end up with, again, along the lines of the other sort of resource inducements that we had for producers in Section C. We didn't want to end up with people carving out pieces. So just as a producer can only transfer the royalty and tax benefits in connection with the sale of their entire North Slope interest, or the company sale itself, we wanted to have a similar, very large rope around this piece so that we didn't end up with a huge administration problem of tracking it.
But I see Mr. Bullock wants to say something.
Yeah, what I was wondering about, I mean, you have a voucher. A gas buyer could assign it to another gas buyer.
And that's what we want. We actually, I think that's something that's missing, and that was why we were deferring a lot of the detailed language about the voucher section to the next committee, because we do want to not allow the sellers to transfer amongst themselves. But as far as a buyer, the only way a buyer of gas is going to be able to transfer this to another buyer of gas is if they actually transfer their entire capacity in the pipeline to another buyer.
Right. That's what I was wondering. Like, if you had a utility in Fairbanks that initially had the voucher, where they could transfer it to a utility in Anchorage,
mm-hmm.
or whether you were simply addressing from the buyer to the gas producer.
Now, whether or not a Calpine might, within its own umbrella, maintain its primary obligation and responsibility to the pipeline company, but subspace out, you know, amongst a group of utilities or whatever. As far as the state's concerned, that's not our concern. That's not our obligation. And they would literally have to do some fairly complicated transactions in order to keep this alive through layers. But as far as the state's concerned, there's one entity we're focused on, and that's Calpine. And is part of the regulatory process that'll have to happen here is any time a Calpine says, ARCO, I'm buying X volume of gas from you for this duration of the sales contract, that will have to flow back to DNR and to DOR so that in their record keeping, they will know who is entitled to the tax, how much, and for how long. And the same was true with respect to the royalty. So there will be state involvement as far as which seller of gas is partaking of all or a portion of the shipper's voucher.
I would suggest a flow chart at some point.
Yeah, it sounds like the flask being passed around in the football game.
Backlash. No backlash.
I hope that line doesn't show up in a court case somewhere. Part of the legislative history, but thank you, Mr. Bullock, for adding some color to the hearing. Any more questions about the transferability of the voucher? Next provision, thank you.
The next provision is on page 26, lines 8 to 11. This is the provision that provides for the development of a program for employment training related to the project. There's no changes in this section. It's just in a different location here. And also, originally, the severability provision was at this point, and it's been moved to uncodified law. The next change is on page 28, on lines 5 and 6. This has to do with an exclusion from the procurement code for certain contracts. And the only change in this section is to take out a reference to abandonment to be consistent with the abandonment section, in which we just focus on whether something's uneconomic. Before, there was a question as to whether if it was uneconomic, it would automatically be abandoned, or it was uneconomic and could continue. This is an attempt to get rid of that issue. And the next changes, we're real close here, is on page 30, starting at line 9 and continuing through line 27. These are the three uncodified sections that I keep referring to. Section 5 states the intent of the legislature that the section that says as soon as practicable, the request for applications will be issued, and this says the legislature has the intent that it happen within 90 days. The next, section 6, starting on line 15 of the same page, is another intent section asking the court to expedite cases that are related to the project that would be licensed under this act. And section 7 is the severability section that was formerly in codified law earlier in the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Bullock.
Yeah, did that. I mentioned I talked to him.
Questions or comments from the members of the committee? Let's take a short recess. issues are still potentially to be discussed by the committee, and we went over the issue of whether we should affirmatively include a sentence that says that if the bill is not approved, the license may not be issued. Senator Terry also has a concern about whether the phrase final administrative action should be included in the bill as a signpost for appeal, and there's some policy issues about whether that should even be in or out of the bill. So that's issue number one to be resolved. Issue number two is Senator Terry.
And that's Senator Wilikowski. I might agree with him, but you said my name.
Oh, I beg your pardon. I got going too fast. Yeah, just for the record, yeah, thank you, Senator Wilikowski. And then there's an AOGCC amendment that Senator Wilikowski is also tinkering with, but maybe you could just state the intent or the idea.
I think everyone has a copy of it in front of them. It's just some rough language. I had sat down with Deputy Commissioner Davis, and she and I were trying to hash out something that would be acceptable, but it would essentially add to page 15, line 15, the net present value of the project, here's where it would add, are necessary as a result of AOGCC rulings. And then on line 19, page 15, after that first word, and, except for changes required as a result of AOGCC rulings. And this really stems from hearings that we had yesterday regarding AOGCC. We all assume that there will be enough gas offtake available, but we don't know for sure. And this creates a potential modification so that if we do get down the line and AOGCC comes out and says, well, you know what, we really can only afford to have 2 BCF offtake, and someone's put in a proposal for 4.8 BCF or 4.5, whatever, that will pose a potential problem. And so this is just a contingency. It's probably nothing that will ever come to fruition, but I think it provides a safety valve for all parties involved.
And what does the administration, excuse me, what does the administration think of that?
Ms. Davis?
Yes, Senator Huggins, through the chair. We're comfortable with this language primarily because our concern was, while we're very comfortable that we're comfortable, just like the producers are comfortable, that there's 4.3 or 4.5 as a reasonable design criteria for a pipeline coming off the North Slope. If you're an applicant that is not in that inner circle of the producers, or you're not like the state and been made privy to the inner circle information, but you're just sort of shooting from the dark and relying upon what you're hearing, and you're staking a lot of money on a project design, and you succeed and you're selected as a licensee, down the road, and it may not be very far down the road, it may be once the initial hearings are done with the AOGCC to get a formal offtake ruling, if it comes out that instead of being 4.5 BCF, it looks like 3.8 is more reasonable, or 3.5, they've already submitted a project plan, it's been approved or accepted by the legislature and the administration. This modification clause theoretically would not give them freedom to request a modification so they could modify their plan to make it a more economic plan, because it wouldn't be something that would necessarily increase the net present value, nor arguably could you say it's not the result of a changed circumstance outside their control that is not reasonably foreseeable, because we all know that right now there is a question, an uncertainty as to what the gas offtake rate will be on the slope over time. And so we feel if you put in language, if a change is necessary as a result of AOGCC rulings, it will enable applicants to be more willing to step up to the plate and commit to projects.
Senator Huggins.
Right. But on the other hand, I just want to ensure that this doesn't allow a modification that would be of questionable value to the state ultimately. In other words, the revenue factor off it would be marginal.
Correct. And Senator Huggins, through the chair, the premise, the beginning part of this, subject to the approval of the commissioners. We still have a requirement for approval by the commissioners. We also have the backstop of economic, whether a project is uneconomic. So if someone came back and said, gosh, the gas offtake is half what we thought it was, we're going to wing it and do something. And we look at it and say, that's not an acceptable project. From a state's perspective, we think that's an uneconomic project. We still have that avenue to establish as well. But we have to have some comfort that a company is not going to spend millions of dollars on something that they think is not economic. likewise, there's...
Senator Huggins.
But on the other hand, the maximum benefit factor, I mean, economic and maximum benefit are two different characters.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to make sure our measuring stick here we can live with.
Mm-hmm. Well, what would happen is if there is a substantial reduction in the gas offtake permitted from the North Slope, our opportunity cost, in other words, if there's a project that optimizes and takes that full chunk of gas off the slope, it isn't like we can say, well, there's a better project, there's a different project, because that's the ultimate limiter, is how much gas can come off the slope. So I hear what you're saying, which is someone will come forward and say, well, I've got a project, and it's, instead of being having a net present value to the state of $5 billion over time, now it's been cut back to $2 billion over time. That's not good, and we'd look around going, is there a better deal? And there probably isn't, because there's a finite amount of gas that can be taken off. So the question would be, if you said no to that, we think that's too low, we want to shop for something better. If the limiting factor is the gas offtake, it is what it is, and we all have to deal with that as the commercial reality, and it's sort of the max or the cap of what we can get.
Or additional exploration.
Absolutely. Absolutely, and that would modify all projects, correct.
Mr. Bullock.
The way I read this section is that if the economics look like they're going south, that this is the first thing you try and do. You try and salvage the project. You still see whether it can continue with a reasonable return to the state. If it doesn't, then you migrate toward whether the project's become uneconomic or not, and then you go to the abandonment section. So this gives you a chance to stop and look at it and see where you are, see whether it can be salvaged or successfully modified, and then you can continue with the project.
Other questions on this topic? The next item I've identified as a potential amendment is to on page 17, and that's regarding an amendment to use the national rosters for all arbitrators being selected. Is that the thrust of your amendment, Senator Wilikowski?
Yes, my idea is typically, if the way this is worded right now, I think what would happen is AAA would send a list of probably 11 arbitrators, and there are probably very few arbitrators that can do these types of cases, and we shouldn't limit ourselves. We should open it up, in my opinion, to the entire national roster. We pick one from the entire roster. The other side picks one from the entire roster, and then those two get together and pick one from the entire roster. And I don't think we have that right now, so I think, we would want to add some language that clarifies that.
It's a little unclear, and I think actually what you're describing is what I had in mind when we started down this path, was to make sure we selected arbitrators out of a pool of recognized national, arbitrators, is what I had in mind. So that's more or less along those lines. Any other questions about that topic? The other topic related to this is what happens upon a decision of the arbitrators. Senator Huggins, I don't know if you're here, but I'll just restate my concern is that any two arbitrators can put an end to this project. Any two arbitrators who agree that it's uneconomic breaks the chain and the project's over. The gas line stops and we go back to square one. And it may be that that's the right decision. It may be time to get out of that. It may be us asking to get out and to end a bad marriage. But I wanted to make an explicit avenue of appeal if the arbitrators have abused their discretion. That's a fairly high standard to overcome, but I think we need to at least have some guideline to our court should they take up the question of whether that was the correct decision. So I'll be preparing an amendment along those lines. Any questions or comments on that topic?
Well, I don't know. I don't really think about national order of merit of arbitrators, but they abuse their discretion.
What's this common standard?
Mr. Bullock, maybe you can speak to that.
Generally, on an appeal of administrative decision, and this would be similar to that, the court has a couple things they look at. They look at decisions that can be made within the discretion of whoever's the decision maker is. And this not only applies to the arbitration board in this case, but also is going to apply to the commissioners when they're going through all the applications. And unless there's abuse of discretion, which means that they'll look at the decision that was made, in this case by the panel, and they will look at the record and see if the evidence supports the decision they made. If it doesn't, then they can say they abused their discretion, that they didn't make a reasonable decision based on the evidence that they had before them. So they, in other words, the court avoids second-guessing a fact-finding decision unless they look at the record that was made and say that it's just so far out of line, it's inconsistent with the evidence.
And so we're holding the arbitrators to the same standard of review, if you will, that we're holding the commissioners when they make their decisions.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Wilikowski.
I might disagree a little bit with Mr. Bullock on that. In my experience, it is virtually impossible to overturn an arbitration decision. And I'm not sure that's what you intend, Mr. Chairman. We may want to consider having it be a substantial evidence decision, so we give the court some leeway. But you're right. I mean, the way if we don't do anything, then the courts will administer this, in my opinion, under an abuse of discretion, which is virtually impossible to overturn. And maybe we want that. On the other hand, we may decide, and I'm not sure that is the standard for commissioners. I think the standard for commissioners is more of a substantial evidence standard, where they look and say, was there substantial evidence to support the decision? We may want to give the court that right of appeal. I don't know, something to think about overnight.
Senator McGuire.
Well, I would just speak in favor of keeping the abuse of discretion standard because it is a commercial contract and it's a commercial situation. And I think that parties will be more comfortable to apply and to enter into and apply for a license if they know the method by which the economic determinations will be made, if you will. That's been one of the cruxes of it, and I think that changing that well-recognized standard might make parties uncomfortable and leery. And I also am concerned that there needs to be some finality to that, that the arbitration process means something, and that the parties each get to select their own, those two select a third, and that there will be finality to that, that it will be based on a factual analysis. And otherwise, I worry that you thrust yourself back into another round of litigation that is never ending. And it could be that we want to end it.
And I think that's exactly right. It's a tough policy call. I don't back away from how difficult a decision it is. It may be us wanting to get out. It might be them wanting to get out. Who knows? But I think there has to be finality. Other questions? Mr. Bullock.
You know, Senator Wilikowski brings up a good point because the court is kind of flexible in this area. Sometimes it looks like it's abuse of discretion and it's kind of like substantial evidence. They kind of use a combination. Like, normally they reserve themselves the right to decide questions of law that don't require expertise, but sometimes it's surprising what they will consider agency expertise and then defer to it compared to an issue that they would exercise their independent judgment on. So it is kind of a fluid situation.
Other questions or comments on this? The last item on my list is Senator Terrio brought up the issue of the Constitution. He didn't bring it up, but it got discussed, the constitutionality of the pipe coordinator confirmation and whether we have the authority, the constitutional authority, to require legislative confirmation of this pipeline coordinator when it's not referred to specifically in the Constitution as being that sort of post which requires legislative confirmation. I think it's a fairly low-stakes question, mainly because we're setting this person up to serve at the pleasure of the governor. Senator Terrio, have you decided if you're going to offer an amendment on that?
I think I will, Mr. Chairman. It's just, you know, we have rules and we have legislative confirmation because of particular hurdles. We could set up legislative confirmation of lots of governor appointments, and we don't, and nor should we. So.
Any other questions or comments on that topic? Senator McGuire.
Only comment I'd made, through the chair, I don't disagree, actually. I think we're splitting hairs on this particular topic, but I don't disagree with Senator Terrio. My office did alert me they were going to get the backup that Drew Pierce was confirmed by Congress.
Okay.
So just as a matter of correcting the record, earlier we spoke that she may not have been, she was appointed by the president and may not have been confirmed. Not that we would have to follow that model, but.
Okay, so here's my game plan, which is we've identified five issues. I'm going to prepare a written amendment, and I'd ask the other members to do the same I'm going to prepare a written amendment on number one, which is license has to be approved. If it's not approved, it goes away, it dies. And to amend the state appeal standard for arbitration to abuse of discretion, that's one. And four, I'm going to ask Senator Wilikowski to do amendments on two and three, and Senator Terry to do a written amendment on number five, and ask that those be to my office by 10 o'clock tomorrow. And if there are other things that come to your mind overnight, get them in writing, get them drafted, and get them to the office by 10 o'clock so we can have an orderly exit strategy. Senator Wilikowski.
There was one other thing which I had requested in the hearing, earlier hearing, that was on the definition of competing natural gas pipeline project. And that was page 25, lines 2 through 4. And I'm still not satisfied with that definition. And perhaps I'll try to work on something overnight. I'm worried that, I mean, I guess my worry is that we'll preclude the potential. I mean, we've heard the number of potential projects, which I don't think compete with this project. But for in-state gas, we're desperately trying to figure out how to get in-state gas to South Central and all of Alaska, and I'm not sure that this definition works.
Senator McGuire.
On that point too, I think we had also discussed, or at least I have discussed with someone, I can't remember which hearing, the concept of treble damages and whether it should be treble or two times or what that penalty should be. And I'm also equally troubled by the definition. We just heard a presentation in resources on an in-state, a potential in-state line that would be a smaller line that would bring gas down to my constituents. So I just want that clear.
Is this the NSTAR proposal, yeah, that's going around the building?
Yeah. Who knows if it'll be a reality, but it's the kind of hypothetical that you can envision very clearly, that you wouldn't want us having to pay treble damages over something like that.
So it sounds like you two are going to work together on an amendment.
She is.
She's the only one that knows.
Other?
I'll work.
Senator Huggins.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, you said you were going to get a reading on the pipeline coordinator functions. One was any project, one was the project.
Yes, I think I sent a memo over to Mr. Bullock. Did you get a memo on that from me, a request?
I haven't seen it.
I beg your pardon. The question was whether there are any constitutional problems with having a pipeline coordinator working on a single project, and compare and contrast that to the federal coordinator who can work on any project. Is that the accurate? Yeah. And so I just wanted to make sure we weren't there weren't some federal law preemption issue or some equal protection issue or some problem with assigning a state pipeline coordinator to work on just one project, and whether we weren't whether there are any constitutional impediments to that issue. I thought I'd taken care of that, but I must not have. Other concerns, issues? Senator Terry.
Mr. Chairman, I'm likely to bring up the issue of the length of the approval process for the legislature, just for a possible vote. So, but that's fairly simple, just a number.
The time during which we'd be considering the.
Does anyone else care about treble damages besides me? I mean, and maybe I could just hear something from Marsh, just real quickly refresh my memory about why. I mean, treble is a common term in the law. It's a common form of damages. Why three times the amount versus?
Again, I mean, you can always just we could say right. 285. I mean, right. I mean, a number is a number, and I think you're right that to some extent the idea of 300% has the cachet, and the purpose was to really catch the attention of the applicants so that they knew that we were committed, and that they knew that we really understood the significance of that commitment to them. And by putting in the 300%, you know, you can say, okay, we'll make it 200%. Is that a magnitude of commitment enough to make them want to risk their dollars? In other words, does that give them the investment stability that they're looking for to come to the table and face the other multiplicity of risks that are out there? And just in the totality of it, we just felt 300% had the zing and had the oomph that we needed to make sure that independence came forward.
So, if I might, Mr. Chairman, so in light of that, I really would love to have just a brief, while we're sitting here, discussion about whether or not you think the competing projects part is open enough. For example, I mean, let's just use the NSTAR project as an example. Would you deem that a non-competing project? And kind of walk me through that for
Senator McGuire. Our intent was, by defining on page 25, line 2 through 4, by defining a competing natural gas pipeline project as excluding one that had a throughput of 500 million cubic feet a day or less, that was informed by our understanding of what in-state gas usage would be. That I think there have been some studies that say they could envision maybe 400 million cubic feet usage in the state over the next 10, 20 years. I think maybe it was 20 years. And so we were designing this to capture what we thought would be bullets, pieces that weren't going to compete, truly be competitive to a 3.5, 4.5 BCF a day. So we were looking at the bullet lines, the spur lines that would come off of a main pipeline piece. Because originally, without this qualifier, we envisioned competing pipeline projects to be ones that actually laid in the same, that went to the same destination, started in the same place, and ended in the same place. That's truly competing. You're competing for the gas, and you're moving it to the same location, and people can choose to decide who they're going to ship on, and you create this competition, tariff rates, et cetera. But because we have a comfort level that the major projects are obviously looking to go out of state, we don't see spurs or the bullet lines truly being competitive, affecting the economic considerations of the big projects. Now, I'm not familiar on this particular one by SIMCO, I believe. Mm-hmm. I have not heard what the volume, what they're forecasting as a volume carriage.
I think it was a B.
It's a B.
And I believe, does it also envision going to Valdez or something for export?
No.
Is there any export aspect?
Well,
it to depends. The LNG plant.
Potentially the LNG plant.
Yeah. So essentially they are looking at an export.
In Kenai.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So I mean, the problem is that's not, quote, in-state. That's actually in-state plus an export component. So it would be, once you go there, I think it is problematic to say that a project that is proposing to take gas that is 1B now could be 2B after compression isn't a competitive project. To the extent of the in-state usage, you know, I think we're comfortable to carve that out. But once we go beyond that, I think we are really damaging sort of the concept of what is a competitive pipeline.
So do we just need to add, just as an idea while we're thinking, page 25, top of the page, project designed to accommodate throughput of more than 500 million cubic feet a day of North Slope gas to an in-state market?
Sure.
Would that mm-hmm. shut it down?
Yeah, I just don't see how that project really competes with a project. I mean, it's shipping gas potentially if they to Asia,
right.
whereas all the projections on this show shipping gas to Western Canada or Western United States.
Mm-hmm. Senator Wachowski, you're absolutely right. I mean, if you were to say, okay, someone's done doing their major pipeline and someone else wants to do a spur off of it and take it to Kenai, ship it LNG out, the only way that would be competitive is if a competing pipeline project is if we select a project that is in fact, say, driving its gas to taking it down to Valdez for LNG shipment. You know, in other words, you are being competitive at that point. But I apologize. Certainly, if we select a project that is moving gas from the slope, you know, through, you know, the highway route, whatever, to Alberta and to Chicago, a project that takes gas to Kenai for export to LNG, you know, to Asian markets would not be competitive. It is not, it's not laying in the same trough. It's not taking gas to the same destinations, the same markets. So by without this definition of 500 million BCF, we've sort of migrated. Originally, what is a competing natural gas project was envisioned to be, well, is it competitive? Is it taking gas from to the same markets, to the same destinations? And the answer was LNG, no, compared to Alberta or Chicago. And then we thought, gosh, but, you know, if you're moving gas to gas, Anchorage to Fairbanks, North Slope to Fairbanks, North Slope to Anchorage, and we're asking the main project to have offtake points, you're pretty much in the same trough. You're basically shipping the gas to the same destinations. We don't really want that to be considered competing, so we put in additionally an escape clause for 500 BCF, I mean MCF. And I just forgot about the original intent, which was if it's not competitive, it's not competitive either.
Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. But if you look at the unit of measurement of volume, it doesn't matter where it's going. If you
that's
need
right.
Y volume and they're taking Y minus two, then you run into the same problem.
Absolutely, and that's why I think the suggestion of making it, you know, in state, mediates that somewhat in terms of high volumes. There's not going to be a pipeline project proposed of 3.5 or 4 BCF a day to in-state. It's going to be an out-of-state proposal. And then the question becomes the spur line that comes off of that to deliver in-state will then be accepted by this provision for the smaller increment.
I'll take assignment for that definition. And see what we can hammer out overnight. Yeah, kind of sharp. Any other comments, topics, issues? Everyone have a clear idea of what we're doing tomorrow. If there's nothing else to come before the committee, we are adjourned.